Cindy Gallup wants to build the Y Combinator of sex technology. She's an author, TED speaker, and the founder of Make Love, Not Porn, which aims to revolutionize the porn industry. Here's Cindy.
Cindy, you want to give a brief background on who you are and what you're working on?
Sure. So my name's Cindy Gallup. My background is 30 years working in brand building, marketing, and advertising. I'm passionate about two things, and I have two startups designed to address those. I'm passionate about redesigning the future of... That was a bit loud, isn't it? Is this working okay?
They know what you're about to say, and they want it to be really loud.
I'm passionate about redesigning the future of business with my startup, If We Ran the World, and I'm passionate about redesigning the future of sex with my startup, Make Love, Not Porn. And by the way, both of those things are more closely interrelated than most people realize.
Yeah. I'm trying to redesign my current of sex. It was a bad joke. So first, tell us about the first thing, If We Ran the World.
Sure. So I believe the future of business is doing good and making money simultaneously. The business model of the future is shared values plus shared action equals shared profit, financial profit and social profit. In other words, when brands and businesses come together with their audiences on the basis of values that you all share, which, by the way, is the most fundamental requirement for a good relationship in life, as much as business, and when you are then enabled to co-act collaboratively on those values, you can make things happen in the real world that benefit consumers, benefit society, benefit the brand and its business. So If We Ran the World is co-action software that allows businesses to implement that business model.
Well, and so this is a fascinating topic, but what, I mean, I'm fascinated with this. Who do you think is doing it right? You know, a lot of people throw out this term social enterprise, a lot of people throw out this term impact investing. Some people think that just kind of standard VC is doing a pretty good job, as is making an impact without explicitly calling it making an impact. Where do you kind of stand in who's doing it right? And what do you want to see more of?
Well, Eric, this is very subjective, but I believe that very few people are doing it right at the moment, because the old world order model for doing good and making money goes, we make money here, and then we do good by writing checks to causes to clear our conscience over here. Whereas I believe the future is we make money because we do good. We find a way to integrate social responsibility into the way we do business on a day-to-day basis that therefore makes it a key driver of future growth and profitability. And very few people are doing it like that.
And do you think that is, how does that happen? Is that regulation that's going to happen? Is that just, you know, national conversation and ethics? And kind of, how do you think it's going to happen over time?
Well, this is absolutely what If We Ran the World is all about, because I don't believe that change happens from the top down. The old world order model of making things happen top down through hierarchies, organizations, institutions is broken. There's a new bottom-up model emerging of collaborative people power and collective action. And so change happens through micro-actions. Every single one of us doing tiny things every day to make this happen add up cumulatively to very, very big change.
What are your thoughts of Professor Mohamed Yunus's model for social business?
I think that micro-lending generally, micro-financing, is a fantastic idea. But the difficulty there is that many people kind of see that as a whole separate siloed social good initiative. I would love to see that principle, again, of making small things happen, integrated into every single business in a way that drives change throughout the whole business. And so there can be a tendency to go, oh yeah, there's good stuff like that happening over there, so we don't have to worry about it. Or we can just donate to that, and that'll make that happen, and that's us doing good. And I really want to see this pervade all forms of business.
So you think the Bill Gates model is kind of in the past of, you know, do very well and then start your own foundation? You think it's kind of integrated? What are some kind of examples of businesses that are doing a great job right now?
Do you know, honestly, Eric, there are very, very few of them operating in the way that we're talking about. The model of, you know, you do your business, you can't do anything that you haven't, you know, been doing previously, and therefore you donate money. It's philanthropy. It's something separate. That's very all-pervasive. I want to change that.
And how are you going about, what is the most effective way have you found to kind of change that? Is it an incremental approach? Is it a radical approach? What do you think?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is So everything in my life and career is accidental. The fact I have two startups is accidental. And I had to park If We Ran the World on the back burner temporarily when Make Love Not Porn blew up. But what I've found is that over time, more and more people are actually getting the idea of a world where the way it works is the more money we make, the more good we do. The more good we do, the more money we make. And so the business world is catching up to this. And I'm finding people really want to have this conversation and find ways to make it happen. So I'm very encouraged by that, and I'm absolutely having those dialogues.
Eric Willis from the audience has a question. How do you implement something like it, where something like this, where an environment where public companies are driven by short-term profits? I like the bottom-down philosophy, but there are institutional mechanisms that would need to be overturned.
No, absolutely right. And that's why the ideal way to go about this is to subvert the business from within. And so I support myself through paid consultancy and public speaking. And I often get asked from the audience, you know, I work in huge corporate machine. How can we make change happen? And, you know, I say everything starts with micro actions. Enough motivated people within the company demonstrating that you can do things differently and make money. I go take one small project, carve off a piece of a project, demonstrate traction. You know, actually a lot of this is the whole minimum viable product, agile approach anyway. And you can actually have the company take that on board because they can see it makes sense.
How are you thinking about Silicon Valley as kind of, you know, how? What are some of the things that you think most need to be, you know, changed within this ecosystem?
Well, gosh, there are a host of answers to that. I mean, first of all, obviously, I'd love to see the model we're talking about, shared values plus shared action equals shared profit, adopted generally. And by the way, when entrepreneurs talk to me about ventures where they say, I want to start a non-profit that does this, I go, don't do that. Make it a for-profit business. You should absolutely be able to do good and make money simultaneously.
Why are you against nonprofits, or you just don't think they're as effective?
In order to make what I want to see happen, we have to prove that it works. I'm all about communication through demonstration. And so when people have a really interesting idea that I can see could be making money at the same time as doing good, I'd much rather they did that. Very unfortunately, nonprofits get marginalized. You know, in the same way that corporate social responsibility divisions within businesses get marginalized, there's a real tendency to think, oh yeah, those are the chaps over there who give our PR companies something to talk about. Well, we all get on over here with a hardcore data business of making money. Until you bring those two things together, nothing's going to change. And I want to do everything I can to make that happen.
So you tell the people who are running nonprofits to just try to start?
No, I tell entrepreneurs who come to me with ideas, right, who say, I want to start this as a nonprofit. I go, actually, that could be a for-profit business in this way.
But what do you tell people who are running nonprofits?
I have to tell you that I began exploring the nonprofit world with If Around the World, and I became enormously frustrated by it. And again, it's unfortunate because when you operate in a sector that too many people think is just about doing good and doesn't get taken seriously from a business perspective, you don't get a lot of motivation for best practices, business inspiration. And so there are many things very frustrating about the nonprofit sector, not least of all, the fact that you can have a number of nonprofits tackling the same thing, competing with each other. As much competition happens there, when you could be doing so much more by collaborating and all tackling the same issue together.
What do you think the role of government is in this? Can they do anything?
Oh, that's. I feel a bit about government like I feel about the UN. The UN is where good intentions go to die, and that happens a lot in government as well.
So what about, is this uniquely American problem, or are there other countries who are doing a much better job at this? How do you think about this?
No, this is an issue all around the world. There are different countries, you know, really trying to drive this approach to business. So I'm giving a keynote at Web de Ghana in Stockholm in Sweden later on this month about precisely this. And Sweden is a country that I've observed people are very keen to make this model work. But it's an issue all around the world.
Give us a background. Make Love Not Porn. How did it happen? What inspired you to create it? Where's
right.
it going?
Okay. So Make Love Not Porn is a total accident. I never set out consciously to do anything my team and I are now doing. I date younger men who tend to be men in their 20s. And through dating younger men, about 7 or 8 years ago, I realized that I was encountering an issue that would never have crossed my mind if I had not encountered it very intimately and personally, which is what happens when two things converge. When today's total freedom of access to hardcore porn online meets our society's equally total reluctance to talk openly and honestly about sex, and results in porn becoming, by default, the sex education today in not a good way. So I found myself encountering a number of sexual behavioral memes. I went, whoa, I know where that behavior is coming from. If I'm experiencing this, other people must be as well. And I decided something about it. So 6 years ago, I put up, on no money, a tiny clunky website at makelovenotporn.com that posts the myths of hardcore porn and balances them with reality. So the construct is porn world versus real world. I had the opportunity to launch it at TED. I took a deliberate decision to be very explicit in my TED talk because I knew that audience wouldn't get this issue unless I was very straightforward. As a result, I am to this day the only TED speaker ever to have uttered the words come on my face on the TED stage, 6 times in succession. The talk went viral as a result, and it drove an extraordinary response to Make Love Not Porn.
6 times in succession?
Yep. Yeah, there was a reason for it. Watch the talk and you'll see why.
So everyone's going to watch the talk, but if you had to, just for point of conversation, if you had to give a brief summary of the talk, what would you say was your thesis and point of?
Yep, it's very simple. Our tagline is pro-sex, pro-porn, pro-knowing the difference. That's it. You know, and we're not anti-porn, by the way. The issue isn't porn. The issue is the total absence in our society of an open, healthy, honest conversation around sex in the real world, which, if we had it, would, among many other benefits, also mean people would then bring a real-world mindset when they view what is essentially artificial entertainment. Our entire mission is simply to help make it easier to talk about sex, open and honestly in the public domain, and open and honestly privately in your intimate relationship.
And before exploring that, some people may be asking, what does this have to do with technology scene? It has a lot to do with technology, you know, the tech industry. How would you kind of elaborate on the intersection between what you're doing and the tech industry?
Sure. And I should just explain, by the way, that you know, what that response drove was makelovenotporn.tv, which is an entirely user-generated, crowdsourced video sharing platform that celebrates real world sex. We are tackling it, Make Love Not Porn, the single biggest impact technology is currently having on the most fundamental aspect of ourselves, which is our sexuality, which drives everything about, you know, how we feel about ourselves, our relationships, our lives, our happiness. And yet, this is the one area where Silicon Valley welcomes innovation and disruption in every other area of our lives and work except this one, the one that needs it most. Make Love Not Porn is deploying all of the dynamics that you see in every other part of technology. We are socializing sex. We're making it socially acceptable and socially shareable, as social media does. We are entirely user-generated, crowdsourced. Video sharing is the future. We are part of the sharing economy like Uber and Airbnb. We have a revenue-sharing business model. We are ephemeral, like WhatsApp and Snapchat. You submit your videos, but the moment you don't want them anymore, they're gone. And yet, sex tech is the one area that Silicon Valley is not rushing to invest in, fund, disrupt, and start up businesses in, and oh my God, the opportunity.
Why do you think that is? You know, what do you think, first of all, are there some people who are interested? Are there some investors or influential founders who you're talking to who are fascinated by it?
So, By the way, we're raising a round of funding for Make Love Not Porn right now. Our single biggest obstacle when it comes to getting funding is the social dynamic that I call fear of what other people will think. It is never about what the person I'm talking to thinks, because when you understand what we're doing and why we're doing it, nobody can argue with it. It's always their perceived fear of what they think other people think. And I can tell you that friends of mine have very kindly taken our investor proposal to some very high-profile men investors in Silicon Valley, and they've said to me, oh, you know, this guy doesn't give a damn what anybody thinks. I'm sure he'll get this. Well, let me tell you, it's amazing the men who say they don't give a fuck what anybody thinks. It's amazing just how many fucks are given when it comes to sex tech. That's a problem.
And what do you think kind of 10 years from now, 20 years from now, people are going to get over that? You know, it's going to become more commonly acceptable to talk about. How is that going to change? And once kind of that cultural barrier is passed, what's the door's open to sex tech? What does that look like?
Sure. And by the way, Eric, can I just say, I'm enormously grateful to you and Ryan and Product Hunt for your support and for being here today. I was thrilled when Chris Messina posted Make Love Not Porn on Product Hunt. I mean, I hadn't even thought of trying to be on Product Hunt because I wasn't sure that you'd accept us. I love the welcome you gave us. I really, really appreciate the fact that I'm on this stage today.
Absolutely.
And I particularly appreciate it because the interesting thing about the future you're talking about is... the March issue of Wired is their sex issue. They're doing what every tech blog does currently, which is talk about the future of sex as virtual reality porn, this hardware, you know, this connectivity. Actually, the future of sex really matters in terms of our humanity. And what Make Love Not Porn is doing, and what other friends of mine in the sex tech world are doing in that area, is not being covered. Because the most important thing is not, you know, sex on Oculus Rift. It's not VR. It is... We want to change the way the world has sex for the better. It's about how we're connecting as human beings. Make Love Not Porn operates in the single biggest market of them all. Not porn, not sex, the market of human happiness. That's the future of sex that I want to impact. And that's the future of sex that not enough people in technology are actively thinking about currently.
So to expand on that, paint us your world. You know, everything happens the way you want it to happen. What does that look like?
Do you know, at a very basic level, what it looks like is... amazing communication around sex. I said Make Love Not Porn was an accident, but what is no accident is that I've spent 30 years working in advertising, in the business of communication. I know that everything great in life and business is born out of great communication, and sex is no different. Overly porn-influenced sexual behavior is driven by the best of all possible motives, not the worst. Because we all get very vulnerable when we get naked. Sexual egos are very fragile. People find it bizarrely difficult to talk about sex with the people they're actually having it with while they're actually having it. Because you are terrified that if you say anything at all about what's going on, you will potentially hurt the other person's feelings, you'll put them off you, you'll derail the encounter, you'll derail the entire relationship. But you want to please your partner, you want to make them happy. We all want to be good in bed. And so you'll seize your cues on how to do that from any way you can. And if the only cues you've ever seen or been given are from porn, then those are the ones you'll take to not very good effect. And so I see a world where we all feel able to communicate openly and healthily with each other around sex in a way that means that we all have fantastic sex lives and we are closer to world peace. Because if more of us were having more sex and more better sex, the world would be a happier place and we would be a lot closer to achieving world peace.
That's awesome. And you've also, you know, you mentioned Chris Messina earlier, and I want to set you up for this too. There was recently an article, I think in USA Today or some major, you know what I'm talking about.
I do indeed,
about
yes.
About kind of the San Francisco, Silicon Valley and polyamory and just that as a lifestyle. What are your thoughts on that?
So I am deliberately very public about the fact that I date younger men. And I'm public about that not because I'm saying everyone should do what I do, but because I believe that everyone should be free to design the relationship model that works for them, which may, by the way, be different at different stages in your life. There's this very limited number of relationship models society says it's okay for us to operate. And so I believe that we would all be a lot happier if we took the time to stop and think, forget about what my parents have always told me I must do. Forget about what society tells me I must do. What would really make me happy? What am I all about? What are my life values? What are my sexual values? What kind of relationship would I like to be in? And I'm going to design that relationship model and live that. And we'd all be a lot happier as a result.
It's fascinating. As the culture barriers continue to erode and sex tech becomes more prevalent, what are, you know, if you're designing this, let's say you're designing kind of an incubator around this, or you know, the landscape for it. What are some things that people should be legitimately worried about? And what are some other opportunities? What businesses do you want to be built in this X space besides yours?
Sure. So I'd like to highlight the single thing that everybody here should be worried about, which is that the average age today at which a child is first exposed to hardcore porn online is 8. And a global study done last year by Bitdefender indicates that age has now dropped to 6. And this is not because 8-year-olds and 6-year-olds go looking for porn. They don't. It's a function of what is inevitable in the digital world we live in today. They stumble across it. Most wired generation ever, in privileged households, they have access to iPads, laptops. Parents write to us all the time. And so we have an entire generation growing up learning about sex from porn. And parents are still really, really nervous about talking to their kids about sex. That doesn't happen often enough. So in order to attack that, the answer is not to shut down, censor, clamp down, block, repress. The answer is to open up. Open up the dialogue in the way that we're trying to make love not porn. Open up, to your point, Eric, to welcoming, supporting, and funding entrepreneurs who want to disrupt this world for the better. And open up to allowing us to do business on the same terms as everybody else. And so I already know what my next venture will be, because if I can get Make Love Not Porn to do what I want, which is do a shit ton of good and make a shit ton of money, I want to start an incubator accelerator fund for radically innovative sex and porn tech startups. I want to be the Y Combinator of sex. Because my young friends in the porn industry have brilliant ideas, they're creating interesting content, they want to redesign the future of porn. Make Love Not Porn has brought to many sex tech entrepreneurs who want to change the world through sex. We all have the same problems. We can't get funded, we can't put payments in place. And these are all ventures that would open everything up, make it a lot healthier and happier to deal with sex, to talk about it, and that's the future and the world that I want to live in.
And what's it going to take for the people who are either too shy or too scared or too uncomfortable to talk about it or to even look at it, to look at it and to talk about it?
Do you know, it's like anything else. The single most crucial social dynamic to scale, to drive movements, is the one that is best described as everybody's doing it. So I had a very personal example of that last Monday. I was on the phone to my 84-year-old father in London, who informed me, to my hysteria, by the way, my 84-year-old father has just started reading 50 Shades of Grey because, and I quote, everybody else seems to have. That is the power of everybody's doing it. And so what will get people to open up is what I say to my team, which is we just have to find a way to keep going and the tipping points will come. You know, the first investor who puts their hand up and says, we're loud and proud to support this. You know, the first people who go, this is absolutely what should be happening. Everybody else falls in behind. Everybody is dying to talk about sex. Everybody, you know, rushes to discuss it with me, writes to me all the time. You know, the moment we make everybody feel good about this, normalize it, socialize sex, you will see extraordinary things happen. And that's the future we're out to make happen with Make Love Not Porn.
Perfect. Everybody, give it up for Cindy. That was a hell of a talk.
Thank you. Eric, thank you so much for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.